This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thunderstorms packing strong winds moved across portions of Illinois and Indiana yesterday. Trees and power lines were blown down. Property damage, no injuries, not so bad. But there are times when wind is cruel here in Illinois and Indiana. In our part of the world, straight line and tornadic winds associated with thunderstorms are feared and respected. So too, high winds in drought, when dust is so thick as to cut visibility to zero. And winter winds, they'll slice through you as if you were a carrot in a Cuisinart. That's the dramatic. But what of gentle winds and cooling breezes? A warm rush of air in January from the Gulf of Mexico. Today's welcome breezes out of the Northwest. This afternoon, today here on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll learn more about wind, a force of nature that shapes the physical landscape and guides our decisions about where to live. Our guest is writer Jan DeBlue, author of Wind, How the Flow of Air Has Shaped Life, Myth, and the Land. Tales of your experiences of wind, memorable stories you've heard about wind, and, of course, your questions about wind are welcome. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Jan DeBlue is the author of three books, including Hatteras Journal and Meant to Be Wild. The latter was chosen as one of the three best natural history books of 1991. And her book, Hatteras Journal, is now available in paperback. Call us with your questions and comments, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Jan DeBlue, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's very nice to talk with you. You live on the Outer Banks of North Carolina.
That's right. Yes.
And in your book, you write, "I live in a land of great wind, and it defines me."
Absolutely. How can I say that wind defines me? I think I thrive on wind is the best way to say it. If there's a big storm coming, rather than hiding inside, you know, a nor'easter, which really tends to be the characteristic storm of these parts, other than hurricanes. But in a nor'easter, what I want to do, rather than being inside, is to go out and look into the gale and see what the ocean is doing and just kind of try to take it all in.
Yeah. What's the wind like today?
It is. You know, this is the one wind I don't like, I must say. This is the blast furnace wind, the no wind of summer. It's southwest and about 25 knots, and it would just make people feel miserable.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, to tell you the truth, the southwest wind was one of the things that got me interested in writing about wind to begin with, because, you know, in the summertime when you have a southwester just howling, everyone is so cranky and irritable. And then, you know, in the space of an hour, if the wind turns out of the northeast, the day becomes cool and wonderful. Everybody feels energetic. What you want to do is just go out and jump in the ocean and you know, lounge mm-hmm. on the beach. And, you know, it's amazing to me how just a simple twist of wind can really change the entire feel of the day.
Yeah. Well, we went in the space of 24 hours here from hot and humid and that wind out of the south and southwest to today's gentle breezes out of the northwest, and it is discernible in the way people walk and talk today. I mean, the difference between yesterday and today is noticeable. I mean, it's quite plain.
It's interesting because I talked to some people in Phoenix last night, and they had just gotten it yesterday. I'm hoping that it's heading this way and we'll be the recipients tomorrow. I can't wait, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But to think about the way the wind rolls across the country, you know, an entire continent. You know, Phoenix has it on one day and you have it the next, and then we're going to have it out on the coast, you know, tomorrow. To me, that's a really interesting idea, too. You know, we know what's going to happen to us and how we're going to feel. And, you know, this is kind of a new age in that sense. The people who lived even 50 years ago had no idea what the weather was going to be like and what the winds were going to do to them.
Mm. You say you often feel the wind like a dragon.
How so? You know, I came up with that image. I was trying, this was in an essay that I wrote. I came up with the idea of writing a book about wind after I had written an essay about the way the wind has shaped the people and the culture of the Outer Banks. And One of the things that I noticed was that wind has a lot of personality and force out here, and it really, it changes personalities from day to day. But more than anything, what I always think of it as is a dragon. And this came from one day when I was standing out on the beach looking into a northeast wind and thinking, you know, I know that the wind is simply a current of air molecules sliding from high pressure to low pressure. But I'll tell you, right now, with my hair beating against my eyes standing out here, it feels more like the roaring breath of a dragon that lives just over the horizon.
Mm.
And, you know, I just really like that image. You know, and I keep using it throughout the book because, it fits the image of the wind as alive and kind of unpredictable, and you know, you never know if it's going to be roaring or if it's going to be docile.
Yeah. Well, when I think of dragon, I think of a fire-breathing animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in a nor'easter,
it's cold. Yeah. So I mean, and that's of course an image that doesn't quite fit, but still, you know, when you think of wind later on in the book, you know, I use that image very early, and then later on I begin talking about wind as possibly a god that can take on any persona or any appearance anytime it wants and just, you know, change at will. But, you know, today the image of a dragon is very apt because it is so hot.
Yeah.
And even, you know, when it's cold, you know, there's such fury that what you want to compare it to is an animal that's very, you know, that we don't understand. It's kind of mythical. And that's why I kind of hung on to that dragon image.
What does it feel like to be in a nor'easter, and how might it change the landscape in subtle and not so subtle ways there where you live?
Nor'easters are interesting storms. A lot of people are very frightened by them. The air grows very damp and heavy. You know, when I mentioned earlier that a northeast wind can make the day feel wonderfully cool and just give you a lot of energy, I'm speaking, of course, about a light wind, not light northeast wind. A heavy northeaster can be frightening in that it sets up the surf so badly. That's, you know, one obvious way.
Mm-hmm.
But on the back side of the islands, it also pushes water out of the sounds. You know, we have a wide sound that is in between the mainland and the barrier islands. Actually, you know, two different sounds from north and to south. And the water in the sounds gets shunted to the west. And, of course, you know, the waves may be spilling over the oceanfront dunes and threatening property. On top of that, you know, we get a lot of tree damage, and salt builds up on the power lines, and we have a lot of power outages. In Hatteras Journal, my first book, I write about, you know, I write that living out here is really something akin to living in a banana republic because we don't have any kind of reliable electricity. You know, the power can go on and off really without much warning, just on a day-to-day basis, even when there isn't much wind.
Mm.
But, you know, again, it's the wind that causes the damage. The salt builds up on the lines, and boom, suddenly no power.
Yeah. How do the winds of a nor'easter differ from the winds of a hurricane?
Well, you know, northeast wind, you're going to get a straight stare down on the Outer Banks. We get northeast wind that feels real damp and heavy, but the skies tend to be real blue, and then as the hurricane approaches, water begins being shunted not to the west this time, but up to the north. You'll have the sounds be almost completely emptied out of water as the water is pushed all the way to the north, and then it's, you know, the eye of the storm goes over, and the wind shifts abruptly from the easterly winds back to the west, and a big wall of water will approach and you know, kind of just flood everything in its path.
Mm. You tell us in your book that how we experience wind changes during the course of our lives. Our experience of wind is different when we're children,
mm-hmm.
young adults, when we're old. And our health may also be a factor in how we experience wind. Do you see that in your own life?
You know, I do. I see it when I first moved out here. I've been here 13 years now. And I had wanted to live in some place that was very wild and just open. And I had really always envisioned myself living out west. But here's where I landed. And when I first got here, you know, I began looking around and thinking, wow, this place is so wonderful, and you can't sleepwalk through life out here because, you know, there are all these severe weather systems that keep slapping you awake. And that's really true. And I craved wind. I sought it out all the time. And to some extent, I still do that. But I find that as I get older, especially on days when I'm low in energy or when I'm in a bad mood, I want to hide from the wind more.
Mm.
And the wind affects elderly people in rather severe ways sometimes. You know, it makes them feel so fragile. It makes them aware that, you know, they can, that, you know, I'm sure, this is true for all of us, you know. We're such a small part of nature, each individual, and the wind doesn't let you forget that. And elderly people especially seem to be often afraid of wind.
Mm.
Hopefully I won't be, but you never know.
It has the power to take our wind away, take our breath away.
Oh, absolutely. And to do our breathing for us to some extent. You know, there were days when I first got here where I had a favorite dune and I would go and sit on it on Hatteras Island, and I could see nothing on the horizons except earth and sky, and earth and or water and sky. And you know, in a gradual wind, the waves would be breaking, you know, in a very rhythmic pattern. And it seemed to me like the wind was pushing the waves ashore, and at the same time, filling my lungs and doing my breathing for me.
Hmm. Somewhere where I would like to go very much, Mount Washington, Vermont.
Uh-huh. Is that North New Hampshire, actually?
Oh, that's right. You've been there.
Yes.
And you write about it in your book, Wind. Tell us what it's like there.
It's a land that is absolutely shaped by wind. For some reason, as the wind moves over those mountains, the Presidential Range, and scientists are not even sure how the wind, you know, patterns are set up out there. You know, there's never been a really good study of the exact flow patterns of wind over the Presidential Range. But as you move up the side of Mount Washington, you can see the plant life change because of exposure to wind. The higher you go, of course, the more the wind. And you start out in this, you know, very nice deciduous forest. It's tall with lots of wildflowers. And as you move up the side of the mountain, the trees become shorter and shorter until they're literally no more than 6 to 8 inches tall. It's a special kind of dwarf tree called crumuls. And then you move into an area where there's just simply, you know, kind of small cedars only, you know, like a few inches high. You know those cedar plants that people plant in their front yard for decoration, decorative
mm-hmm.
purposes? There are cedars like that growing wild on the sides of Mount Washington, on the west side especially. And then you move into an area of grasses, and then, you know, there's hardly anything. To me, it almost looks like, you know, there's been this great wave of vegetation that's kind of been rolling up this hillside, and it just peters out because it can't survive. The wind won't let it.
And there are some of the highest wind speeds in the world there,
yes,
on
yes.
Mount Washington.
It held the record for the highest wind speed for many years, and it was just that record was just broken by a typhoon just this past, let me see, I guess it was in December.
Yeah.
200, and it wasn't broken by much. It was 231 miles an hour on Mount Washington and 236 in the typhoon. Now, scientists believe that tornadoes contain winds of much greater speed, but nobody's ever been able to measure those speeds. So Mount Washington held the record for a long time.
What is it about that place that the wind can roar there? Why such high winds there?
It has to do with the weather patterns. The Arctic air screaming down from Canada, and as it approaches the Atlantic Ocean, it just is simply able to build up great, great speed. There's the Connecticut River Valley, of course, down on the west side, and you know, the Arctic winds come roaring down from Canada and, you know, build up a great deal of speed, and then they kind of jet up the mountainside, and they're actually squeezed by the presence of the mountain. You know, if you think about putting your finger, taking a flow of water from a hose and putting your finger over the edge,
mm-hmm.
It makes the water go faster. Certainly, it jets out more quickly, and that's what the rise of the mountains does right there. It's an interesting idea. That's how a meteorologist explained it to me.
Yeah. There's an observatory there.
Yes, the Washington Observatory.
What do you suppose it's like to work there? And do those...
Yeah, those folks have a great time. They're really funny. They're wind junkies. That's what we call them. And, you know, they have lots of volunteers that like to work for them. There's actually a position you can get if you're adventurous. You can go and live up on the Mount Washington Observatory with the weathermen and cook for them for a week and see what the weather's like. And when a big wind comes along, I was up there and I talked to some of the meteorologists and I said, well, what happens when there's a really big wind? What do you guys do? Do you hide? And they looked at me and I knew what their answer was going to be,
yeah.
Of course. And they said, we go outside and try to get in it as much as we can. And they showed me a video clip of a really bad windstorm, or I guess to them maybe a good windstorm, in which a man went out in a survival suit to try to slide some tiles back into place on a terrace. And he couldn't even stand up in the wind. The wind kept getting him and rolling him down across the terrace. He ended up having to crawl back to a door for safety. It was, you know, no, and he had this big grin on his face the whole time. It was really funny. You know, he was having a great time.
Our guest this afternoon is writer Jan DeBlue. She's the author of Wind, How the Flow of Air Has Shaped Life, Myth, and the Land. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Your questions about wind are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. Elsewhere, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. What if there was no wind?
We would live in a world with no breath. The air would be so stagnant. Any kind of pollution that occurred in the air would just simply hang over us at all times. The heat would be oppressive. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, could we live without wind?
No. Actually, there was a wonderful Indian myth, an Abenaki myth, about a man who wanted to go fishing, hunting for ducks, and so he decided to go find whatever was responsible for making the wind, because he couldn't paddle his canoe on such a windy day. And so he climbs a mountain in search of the wind and finds that the wind comes from the wings of a great eagle, and he binds the eagle's wings and throws it in a crevice and goes back to hunt, and finds that the lake where he wanted to hunt ducks is just a horrible stagnant pond, and everyone's dying from heat, and they can't breathe. And so he says, okay, and he goes back, unbinds the eagle, and admonishes it to sometimes flap its wings hard, sometimes soft, and sometimes not at all. And that is why we have variable winds today.
Mm. Nice story.
Yeah.
It's also, I learned many things by looking at your book, but windy days are in fact better for hunting ducks.
That's what many hunters believe. Certainly, you know, ducks out on open waters, here on the coastal sounds. If you have a day of no wind, the waters are very flat, and the ducks can simply spread themselves out all over the place. This is what I was told by a very knowledgeable hunting guide that I spent some time with. But if you go out on a very windy day, you'll find that the ducks can't sit anywhere on the water to feed. They have to seek little protected nooks and crannies. They don't like getting slapped in the waves in the face by whitecaps. And so you find a place where there's a point of land where ducks can kind of congregate, you know, and not be on big rolling water. And you figure, okay, this is a place where ducks might light, and you put out your decoys and you wait. Or you look for a place where you see a lot of ducks flying overhead. You know, you'll see one stream of ducks coming by and then another. And what that means is that a wind shear has developed, and that the ducks are going to be making use of that wind shear. It's, you know, it's like a jet of air, a current of air. And what this guide said was, you go and you sit yourself down right underneath that spot, because it means that there are going to be ducks flying over the head all day.
Mm. Wind, could we think about wind as kind of a global skin?
I like to think of it that way, certainly.
Yeah.
It's something that seals us to the earth. There are bands of wind and calm that circle the entire globe, you know, from the doldrums at the equator to the spirited trade winds and the spirited westerlies and the horse latitudes, which is a fairly windless band. It's the area of the world in which most of the great deserts have developed. And without that circulation pattern, of course, you know, there would be no global wind pattern. It's interesting to me to think about the wind as working in the same way that a water current works. That's something that really surprised me about doing the research for the book, was to think about how water flows and imagine that wind works exactly in the same way, because it does. Was a great help in picturing, you know, the way that wind works. And so if you think of the world as being surrounded by these great currents, anybody who's ever flown in a plane across country and seen a layer of clouds that are kind of rippled like the sand on a beach.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see exactly what I mean. You know, those clouds, of course, have been pulled and shaped by wind, just as sand is pulled and shaped into ripples on a beach. And there are just wonderful, wonderful analogies about and examples of ways that wind has, that you can see, you know, water patterns in it or current
mm-hmm.
patterns in it.
There's a sacred, I believe it's Hindu text,
mm-hmm.
That mentions, it's ancient, and it mentions water, and forgive me, I can't quote it exactly, and I don't even know how well I will do at paraphrasing it, but there is nothing, it's about water, and there is nothing as soft or so soft as water, yet there is nothing with greater power for breaking things down.
Mm-hmm.
And so too with the wind.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. At one point I say that the wind, there's nothing more like the wind, like my image of God, than the wind, because it can slip through all the cracks in our lives, and it has the power to hurtle us to our faces, completely disrupt our lives, or, you know, fill us with a healing energy.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, the way I look at it.
Some cultures are more attuned to wind. Maybe you would tell us about the sailing talents of Polynesian peoples.
Oh yes. They have an amazing ability to navigate according to the direction that swells are coming from the ocean. You know, they use both the direction of the winds and the feel of waves set up by wind over long distances, and there are differences, great differences between waves that are just set up by a localized surface wind and waves that are driven by prevailing, you know, regional winds. And you know, the Polynesians, of course, explored the world, you know, paddling in their canoes, and it's amazing to think how they made their way from island to island, really without fail. There was a man who tried to use Polynesian sailing techniques to you know, sail quite a distance, and did a good job of it. You know, he had studied with Polynesians, you know, Polynesian teachers for quite some time, and he set out trying to sail from. You know, if you give me a minute, I'll think of where he was sailing from. But what he found was that if he lay down on the bottom of his boat and tried to feel the underlying ocean swell, he could really determine, you know, which way the regional wind, the swells that had set up, had been set up by the regional winds, and he would know what direction he was to travel in, with no compass whatsoever. You know, when we think of ancient peoples who use those kinds of natural phenomena, like, you know, swells and wind direction, to find their way in the world, it's really quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We depend so heavily ourselves on, you know, Loran and compasses and whatnot.
That adventurer, I think you tell us in the book that he talked of or wrote of these swells as almost being interlocking fingers.
Yes. When they come from two different directions, you know, you have a place where the winds join. And I'm, you know, completely blanking out here.
That's okay.
Which I apologize for. But oh, I know it was. His name was David Lewis, and you know, he studied. He sailed from Tahiti to New Zealand, 2,200 miles. That's right. And you know, he didn't. He was sailing with a skilled captain who had depended on charts and you know, modern sailing techniques. But she kept them under lock and key and told him, you know, go ahead and use your traditional techniques, you know, and we'll see how close you get to New Zealand. And at one point she had to intervene to keep them from missing the Cook Islands and sailing into open ocean, which of course would have been, you know, the doom of the sailing venture. But except for that one error, he did make it to New Zealand using just traditional Polynesian, you know, wind navigation techniques. And he had intended to land at, you know, at a certain point in New Zealand, and he was only 26 miles to the south of it. Anyway.
Very, very good. What have we lost as a result of the obscurity of ancient perceptions of wind?
Well, you know, I think that we have taken a lot of the romance out of wind by thinking of it as just simply a current of air molecules moving from, you know, one pressure cell to the next. One of the things I wanted to do in writing Wind was to put some of the romance and the mystery back into the wind, you know, and to think of it as a wonderful organic, you know, healing force. One of my favorite parts of the book is the part on, it's a chapter on the religions and mythology of wind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting to me to look at why, at the fact that many, many ancient peoples explained wind in the same way. They said that, oh, it comes from a hole in a divine mountain, or, you know, it was given to us by a special messenger from God. They also gave it, you know, attributed to it many, many divine powers. I think that the reason for that is that, you know, they couldn't see it, they couldn't explain it, therefore it must be holy somehow. The fact that, you know, that they were living in an atmosphere that was filled with a holy breath, you know, that's a wonderful thought. And I think that by abandoning that completely, you know, to me that's a big loss.
Mm. How has this book changed, I'll say strengthened your faith? Because you've mentioned, this a couple of times in the interview so far. Maybe you could tell us more specifically how this has strengthened your faith.
I don't know that it strengthened my faith, Celeste, as much as it has made me very, very aware of how interconnected life is.
Uh-huh.
One of the really wonderful stories that I heard, you know, comes from the Navajo people, and they believe that, they believe that the wind is actually responsible for the way that a person lives his life or her life. They believe that the holy ones send messenger winds to people that act as their conscience, and what this means is that a person's thoughts and actions belong not just to him, but to the entire holy swirling atmosphere, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thought. You know, it just emphasizes the interconnectedness of life, and not only human life, but animal lives, and all of the natural world. And I think by doing this book, I really, I was very aware of the interconnectedness of people and nature before I started the book, but this gave me a whole new appreciation for it.
Mm. We use all manner of wind metaphor. An ill wind blows, the saw against spitting into the wind, Chaucer's tale where he speaks of breaking wind.
Oh, yes. Actually, you wouldn't believe how many people have asked me if I was putting that in the book.
There's something in the wind. Do you have a favorite wind metaphor?
A favorite wind metaphor? I don't. Not a favorite, I love the wind sayings out here on the Outer Banks. There are many, many local sayings. One of them is, the wind circulates in the northern hemisphere. A fair weather wind moves in a clockwise pattern from, east to south to west, and around the compass in a clockwise manner. And if you see what's called a backing wind, where it moves in a counterclockwise manner, it's an indication that there's a severe storm on the way. And a saying out here is, "I'd rather look at Grandma's drawers than see a backing wind," which I think is a wonderful, wonderful tale for an area that's so besieged by wind.
Yeah. In the book, you introduce us to a guy by the name of Bob Rice. He's a meteorologist.
Oh, yeah. Bob's wonderful. Yeah. He's up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire.
He has a bit of the Polynesian appreciation for wind and weather.
He does, in that he looks. He's a consummate weatherman. He's an interesting fellow too, because he is a weather consultant to people who are involved in wind sports like sailing and ballooning, helium ballooning. He tells them, what are the best winds to try to catch. But he also, in talking to him, I was really interested to hear him describe the wind as an organic force. You have to look at the entire picture. You have to see that it changes and it's alive. And That was really refreshing for me to hear, because I think so many scientifically minded folks, you know, tend to break wind and other phenomena down into inanimate beings, inanimate data points.
Yeah, you quote him as saying, you know, what captured me when you're talking about how he began studying meteorology. He tells you, what captured me was the idea of weather as a living, breathing thing.
Yes.
You don't just type in a bunch of numbers and data. You visualize it. You see waves. You see storm clouds. You see the system.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He's a fascinating fellow. And I think once he began to visualize wind as the entire system, he never intended to be a meteorologist, and now he's one of the best in the world.
Give us an idea of the changes in forecasting winds Bob Rice has seen in his career.
Well, yeah, he was fascinating to talk to, because he's been around in forecasting for several decades, and he says that back in the 70s, when they were just beginning to, try to do, 24-hour forecasts, it took them so long to put together a forecast, just for the next day, that doing a forecast for 48 hours from now was almost like just throwing darts at a board. Maybe it'll be this, or maybe it'll be that. You just could not tell. And now, with the computer models that they've developed, he did say that some computer models are very good, and some are not so good at all. But he says, I just stand in awe of some of the computer models that have been developed.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's sure, weathermen oftentimes, miss the mark. But when you think about what they can do, it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And even good models, mm-hmm. Good computer weather models, sometimes they can be really... They can really fall down.
Oh, yeah.
Even the
best
ones. Now, he doesn't believe that it's going to be possible to model the atmosphere.
No, and what he's talking about in that sense is modeling climatic change, long-term climatic change. I talked to several scientists who said the same thing. We just don't know. The atmosphere is way too complex for us to model, to be able to tell what's going to happen in 50 years or whatever. It's surprising what is being done in terms of forecasting and modeling. There's a man out at Colorado State University, William Gray, and several, other atmospheric modelers who work out there, who are managing to begin to forecast hurricanes. And I want to mention him specifically, because back in 1985, when I first moved here, we began, the people out here, of course, were very attuned to hurricane predictions, any word of hurricanes, and we began to get word that this man in Colorado was trying to predict how many hurricanes would hit in a single season, not hit, develop, just over the oceans in a single season. And we laughed. We thought, who would be so arrogant as to try to do that? And, we looked at the things, the data that he was using to put together these forecasts, including, rainfall, in an African desert, and this and that and the other. And nobody thought it would be possible. Now everybody hangs on his forecasts when they come out. Gray has an amazing ability to really decipher what's happening in the atmosphere that's going to form hurricanes. But again, that's on a month-by-month basis. To forecast climatic change, even within the next 5 years, many people say it's going to be absolutely impossible.
Mm.
And, of course, that brings to mind global warming. Can we really tell what's going on? A lot of scientists say we can't.
Yeah. What is the talk out there on the eastern seaboard at this stage among meteorologists or meteorologists anywhere that you know in terms of this hurricane season and any impact that El Nino might have on it?
Well, El Nino is dissipating, as I'm
right.
sure you've heard. What William Gray at Colorado State has found is that in years after an El Nino, there tends to be more hurricane activity than normal. We have not seen that this year at all. By this time 2 years ago, we'd already had two major hurricanes hit the North Carolina coast. We were really on the edge. Back then, that whole season, the 96 season, was pretty bad. But, they did not come close to us. They missed us by 200 miles.
Mm.
So, when we heard that the El Nino was dissipating, we really we're kind of bracing ourselves for a bad hurricane season out here. So far, so good. You know, that's all I can say. Believe me, we're watching it very, very closely.
Yeah. What's the most terrifying wind situation you've been in?
The most terrifying wind situation
yeah.
I've been in. I don't really get terrified by wind. I've certainly been out sailing on times. You know, we have a little boat. It's a 14-foot O'Day sailor, and there have been times when I've been out in it thinking, you know, maybe I'm in over my head. You know, maybe I can't, and maybe I shouldn't be out here. I write at one point in the book about a day when I was out in some really heavy winds, and the boat is old. You know, I'm not really sure what its capacity for wind is, you know, what its breaking point is, and I really don't want to find out. And I was out one day in a really stiff breeze with lots of white caps on the water. Now, we're not talking about strong winds here. It's probably 18 or 20 miles an hour, which is, you know, tiddly compared to some of the winds that can develop out here. And yet I could not get the boat to turn. It wouldn't come about. And I just, you know, I was trying to head for protected waters, and I was being carried into rougher and rougher conditions because I couldn't get the boat about. And I finally managed to bring it about. And I was so relieved that, you know, at that point I thought, well, wait a minute, I've wrestled the wind at this point, and I've won, so maybe I should keep going. You know, and I did sail a little bit more longer that day, thinking, you know, I'm not ready to quit quite yet. It was an exhilarating experience, and you know, the wind kind of played with me a bit more. And by the time I pulled up to the dock, I really felt like I'd been wrestling an angel that was kind of toying with me.
Wind junkie.
That's me. I'm afraid it's true. You know, I used to. When I was a child, I was really terrified with the notion of being caught in a tornado, which I guess is something that you all have to confront.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how vanishingly small the odds of being caught in a tornado's path are. And, you know, tornadoes still scare me to some extent, I think, because I'm not used to the idea of being confronted with such strong winds with no warning. Out here on the coast, you know, when the mammoth storms that assault us, you know, of course, hurricanes, we have lots and lots of warning. But, you know, my impression is that tornadoes have really shaped the psyche of people in the Midwest.
You talked with some people who have survived tornadoes. What kinds of things did you learn from them?
You know, this was a really interesting section of the book, to me anyway. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was to look not so much at what is known about wind scientifically as how, you know, human culture, both the natural world and human culture, have been shaped by winds. And I wanted to write something about hurricanes and tornadoes, but rather than looking, you know, than telling disaster stories necessarily, I wanted to look at how people have been shaped psychologically by such, you know, mammoth storms. So I found a town in Bellman, Iowa, that had been completely destroyed by a tornado back in 1966. It was one of those situations where the tail of the storm didn't just touch down in the town. The entire wide funnel came down and just plowed a path straight through, you know, the downtown area of Belmond. And I went back 30 years after the tornado just to talk to people about what it was like, you know, to live your life, knowing that your entire way of life could be wiped out in a matter of minutes. And I was really nervous. You know, I thought, what a great idea for a part of the book. And then as I got closer to the town, you know, I was driving north from the Des Moines airport, and I thought, you know, this may be a very sad experience for me. I might find people who are absolutely traumatized, you know, because of their experiences with this tornado 30 years ago. What I found instead was that people were saying, boy, you know, if you could have a tornado plow through your town and get everybody out of harm's way, it might be the best thing that happened to you. I was stunned by that. The people of Belmond know what's important in life. They pull together. They value life over everything else. They don't put overdue emphasis on material possessions, or at least they say they don't, because they know that they can be taken away from them at any time. And the tornado was in many senses a real unifying experience for that community. I was, you know, I kept walking around town going, this can't be right. This isn't what I expected to find at all. But it's really true.
Yeah. A broom. It was a broom.
It just swept it clean.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were, you know, some real interesting stories about what the people heard and felt as the tornado moves through town. The devastating power is just absolutely awesome. You know, somebody saw a tractor trailer kind of on its end waving, you know, bouncing along. You know, strange things happened. You know, a gas station blew over, but a car that was on the lift inside the station, you know, was stayed standing.
I have a family who lived through a tornado, and their home was destroyed, but the dining room was left completely intact, and none of the dishes in the china cabinet were at all hurt.
Now, how does that happen?
I don't know.
No, and that's one of the strange things, is you can look at wind flow patterns and go, this just can't be possible, but it is. That was your family who went through?
An aunt and uncle and cousins.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Down in Miami, I talked to some folks who went through Hurricane Andrew, which, you know, in my mind is the big one, you know, the big hurricane that everybody said was one of these days going to assault the East Coast. It was Andrew. And I talked to some people, you know, down there, and they had some, you know, they had, of course, boarded up their windows and doors, and the wind managed to just peel them off. And there was one corner of their living room where some cockatoos had been left in their cage, and the birds were there just there, happy as could be. Everything else in the house was completely trashed. It's bizarre.
And also with my aunt and uncle and their place, they had a barn, and they never found one piece of it.
Of the barn from the tornado.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just completely
obliterated. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's amazing what nature can do when she gets mad.
Yeah. We're closing in on the end of the time we can spend together today, but I wanted to ask you if, because of what you know about wind now, because of doing this book, if you have new ways of looking at Cape Hatteras, are you a better birder, or...
Yes, absolutely.
You know, are you a better observer of how, you know, nature works?
I think so. Certainly in terms of bird watching, I learned quite a bit about the way migratory animals, you know, migratory birds move through. You know, it's absolutely tied to wind patterns. You know, at one point I say in the book something to the effect of, you know, to animals, wind is a chariot to be ridden. And it's really true. And this is true not only of birds, of course, but of any flying animals. And I find that I pay much more attention to insects now and the way insects move through air because, you know, and use wind patterns, which is real interesting. You know, I'm constantly on the lookout for spiders kind of, you know, sending out shoots of gossamer so they can catch prevailing, you know, the wind and go on to new places.
Yeah, they take advantage.
They do. And it makes sense if you think about, you know, we live, you know, ensconced in, you know, comfortable surroundings, at least most of us do, and completely buffered from wind, but animals have to deal with it and move through it every day, and they're experts on how to employ it.
African desert ants, they find their way back to their nests on sunny days. They apparently use the sun to navigate, but on cloudy days...
They home to the wind direction.
Yeah.
Which way? That's how they find their way back to the nest. And, you know, I mean, one of the really fascinating stories, you know, things that I found, and I know we're running out of time, but the way animals employ wind to make their lives better. Prairie dogs construct burrows in a certain way so that wind will, you know, will cause air to circulate through them, you know, will create a draft, and they'll have lots of, you know, oxygen in their underground dwellings. I mean, that kind of stuff was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
There's this turret spider out here that does the same thing. It puts a little mound on top of its burrow so that air will be drawn into it, or rather out of it, you know, as the wind blows. And, I mean, in that sense, you know, my work on wind and my research on wind has given me such an appreciation for the nuances of the natural world.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I really enjoyed it.
I have too.
And we'll cross our fingers here for you that you'll have some nice cooling breezes soon.
I hope so. Send them my way, please.
Okay, we will.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Jan DeBlue has been our guest. Look for her book, Wind, How the Flow of Air Has Shaped Life, Myth, and the Land. It's published by Houghton Mifflin.